Welcome to the BCMA Podcast. Dr. Rob Lennox is a senior advocacy coordinator at the Chartered Institutes for Archaeologists in the UK, where he undertakes advocacy work to influence policymakers and maintain relationships with external stakeholders. Rob completed his PhD in 2016, exploring the regulation of the historic environment through government policy instruments and the impact the political processes have on the application of sectoral value-driven visions. Through his research and work, Rob aims to develop and demonstrate a strategic understanding of the heritage sector and of its political machinations, as well as conservation philosophy and operations in the planning system. Outside of his work, Rob is a keen mountaineer, hiker, and skier, and enjoys birding. And as an enjoyer of nature and mountains, Rob has a deep appreciation and interest in British Columbia. Thank you, Rob, for joining us today.
Hi, Ryan. So my name is Rob Lennox. I work in the UK for an organization called the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists. I am their senior advocacy coordinator. And so we're obviously the professional institute for the applied archaeology sector in the UK, but also overseas. And we sit within a broader archaeology sector, which sits within a broader historic environment sector, which has links with wider sectors like planning and environment and museums and wider heritage sectors. And together, there is a kind of huge wealth of advocacy that goes on both at a professional level and with public engagement and grassroots activism. And so I am a very small part in that big machine.
We hear from members quite often that advocacy is a word with some unclear definition. When we talk about advocacy, what does that mean to you?
So advocacy is the processes by which influence trading happens. So advocacy can be the traditional sense of insider lobbying, where political systems and members of parliament and individuals with influence are lobbied by interest groups to affect things like legislation and policy change. But crucially for me, I mean, I think that it is a real catch-all term that encompasses everything from that kind of insider, sort of traditionally seen as a shady system where things aren't transparent and access is for elites, audiences only, right down to the grassroots, to where people might be talking about an issue that matters to them in their neighborhoods, a place that matters to them in their neighborhoods, and talking to their neighbors and their friends and, you know, their local systems, and wanting to change things. And so advocacy encompasses from that very grassroots to that very high level. A good approach to advocacy is something which sees that as a single spectrum and which uses the tools that are available to those, both at a very kind of local level and at a much higher, broader level.
And you mentioned tools and a spectrum, and advocacy can encompass so many different forms, from writing letters to making phone calls to sending emails to having one-on-one conversations to marketing campaigns. What kinds of tools do you most frequently work with when it comes to advocacy?
Speaking from my individual job role, I mean, our advocacy, because we are a professional institute, we focus on a very particular range of tools within that spectrum of advocacy. And so our advocacy is very much focused on creating briefing papers, building relationships with politicians and other interest groups and other kind of external groups and bodies, building position by collecting evidence, supporting positions by culturing public opinion, writing letters, and kind of that kind of traditional approach to how do you get to your political representatives. There's also a media side to it. So, you know, putting out press releases to try and build momentum around a particular story or particular issue. But we focus tend to be on the insider stuff. I have worked in the past for an organization which was much more focused on the kind of public side of it, the grassroots side. And there, our kind of core toolkits were about engagement in terms of getting people inspired to want to take part in a process of advocacy. And as you say, you know, you mentioned some of the very common ways of doing that can be as very simple as signing a petition or writing a letter or sending a tweet. There's any action, no matter how small, can be part of a wider process of advocacy.
And you mentioned small steps can be very impactful. And something that I've heard from people is the thought that, you know, if I write a letter, will anyone read it? If I make a phone call, will anyone listen? Do the things I do to advocate for my organization, for my sector, do they make a difference? And in your experience, do those small steps make a difference?
Do you know what? Like, if I had one point that I would like to impress on everybody who cares about a particular issue or thing, it is that you can make a difference by writing that letter. And you know, the letter writing is probably the simplest unit of advocacy for your normal citizen. You can write to your Member of Parliament and they will read it. And this is something that I spend, you know, quite a lot of time talking to people who don't work in advocacy, trying to impress upon them, which is that, I mean, I don't expect the system to be any different in Canada as in the UK, but MPs in the UK care very deeply about the process of democracy. All of them, no matter what political persuasion that they are, no matter, you know, any other kinds of opinions that they might hold, they care about that representative democracy. And in our experience, and this I think is pretty much a general rule, if you are an MP and you receive 10 letters on an individual subject from 10 different individuals who haven't coordinated those letters or sent a stock letter or something like that, that is enough to make somebody sit up and take notice of something. Yes, it might be a member of staff reading the letters because they may receive many thousands. It may be that there is a process by which these things go through to get the genuine attention. And yes, there may be an element of which, you know, you really have to have the right issue at the right time to spark the best reaction possible out of those representatives. But it is possible to influence. It is within your power to have your say through those democratic processes. And I would argue, I would advocate for every sort of small organization to be encouraging their stakeholders, to be encouraging their trustees, their friends groups, to be you know, alive to that potential. Write about the things that you care about. Tell your representatives at a local level, state level, whatever, and you can help to make change on issues that matter to you.
I like that you put a specific number on what you think could be impactful, because 10 is an accessible number of letters that you could get together to write. That if you're a museum, you probably have a board of directors that's, you know, anywhere from 6 to 12 people. And if you got everybody on your board, not even talking about community, to write a letter, then that you're most of the way towards that goal. I think that makes it a bit less daunting in that perspective, think of it in that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, so the most challenging thing, I think, is creating the behavior change in people. Because as you say, you know, there are these challenging, and I accept, off-putting terms, you know, advocacy, lobbying, they're weighted with what people feel that they mean, let alone the weight that comes with the perception of how the political process works and how much trust there is in it and these kinds of things. But that kind of essential opportunity that you've gotten as an individual in society to write to someone to say, I care about this thing and I think you should take note of it, is not powerless. And when that happens on a broader group, it can really work. So the challenge then is, how do you create that behavior change in people? How do you convince your, let's say every museum, every local museum has a dozen or so real kind of high level volunteers and maybe a few dozen people who are really closely engaged with the community. It doesn't take a huge stretch of the imagination to skill those people up to know how to write a good letter. And I'm talking about very simple techniques like, don't be aggressive. Make sure that you ask a specific question so that the person you're writing to is forced to give you an answer. Make sure you're not conversely, asking them 20 separate questions, because that's way too much to load onto somebody. Focusing what information that you give them so that you're being convincing enough, but not taking too long to say it. You know, there's a kind of range of very simple tools for an action like writing a letter, which getting those skills out to the people in your networks, your stakeholder groups, and then helping them to say, this really will matter, this really will help us, so please go away and write that letter. It shouldn't be beyond any organization, large or small, to be doing, you know, things in that scope.
A lot of our members may not be super familiar with the UK heritage sector. What are some advocacy topics that are important for the sector right now?
You've caught me at the end of a very busy day of COVID-19 response planning and guidance writing and impact gathering, and also in a period where we are seeing significant reform proposed in the planning process. Broadly, you know, the heritage sector interlinks with so many different areas of society that there are heritage angles on a lot of things. You know, we're just at the time of speaking to you, coming out of several weeks of protests around Black Lives Matter campaign, and we've seen a prominent statue in Bristol, UK, toppled by protesters, and the heritage angle on those debates has been really powerful and really valuable. And that's just a single example of something that you're going to think, well, how relevant is heritage? The reality is that the challenges that we face as a sector are about how we contribute to all the important national agendas: climate change, the environment, as I say, planning reform, tax structures. There are challenges facing us in terms of how we present what heritage contributes to our lives across all of these areas. And I think the main challenge for heritage, for museums, for archaeology, is to mainstream the value of what we do into all of those agendas, and finding the platform that gives us the voice to be part of those things, and changing the perspectives of government that might see museums or heritage as a polite but ultimately not terribly important issue, by saying, how do we contribute? What would happen to society, to economy, if we weren't here? It's trying to how to maximize our voice in a world where there are so many important issues and so many different voices clamoring for the space to be heard.
Something I find with museums, cultural centers, galleries, is that the people who work there are very aware of the impact they have in their community and in society, but sometimes don't feel comfortable talking about that impact, whether it feels like they're, you know, bragging or making their organization sound like it has a bigger impact than they do. In your experience, what are some effective ways to talk about and quantify the impact that your organization or sector has?
If you read any books about advocacy or activism, I promise you that in the first 5 pages of the introduction, you'll find something that talks about how difficult the cause and effect is to prove in advocacy campaigning. It's a very difficult one to sell in terms of measurement. And in our organization, you know, you mentioned that there are wild claims that go around about who's caused what particular policy reversal, or who's been responsible for achieving this change in approach of a, you know, local government or something. And the reality is that very rarely are you able to point to something where your group has been the sole instigator of that change. But I am very happy with the idea that I am a part of a process, that when an event occurs which stimulates a public response, that my organization and my role within it is such that I have a meeting with a minister or a member of parliament, or maybe a few, and I am able to begin the process of turning a cog, often supported by wider voices and wider kind of public awareness and legitimacy coming from general feelings in society or specific things that you might be hearing. So, you know, to give an example, a kind of major watershed moment in British archaeological history is the moment at which it became a comprehensive part of the planning process. So by that, I mean that every planning application for a development, whether it's to build a house, a road, has to go through a system of checks and evaluation for archaeological risk. That came into the planning process in England in 1990. And in at similar times in different parts of the UK. And that was the result of a series of events that that really upped the pressure on government to see this as a problem and to get some kinds of outcome from it. And one of the events which is often pointed to as being a key event was the discovery of Shakespeare's Rose Theatre in Southwark in London. And this kind of discovery was made fairly regularly at the point that the bulldozers have moved into a site where no prior evaluation has been done or no opportunity to assess a site for what archaeological heritage might exist on the site. And the discovery of this hugely important piece of Elizabethan theatre history inspired a huge public response. How was this allowed to happen? I'm sure the government at the time and every MP was receiving those 10 letters and more from their constituents saying, how does this happen? At the same time, organisations like mine were going in to speak to government to say, listen, this is how you sort this problem. Going back to your question about how do you get cause and effect, what kind of things are you responsible for achieving? Well, who was responsible for that huge change? Well, it was about the public response. It was about the context in which that public response was able to kind of achieve a critical mass. It was about the responses of not just one, but a dozen of organizations. And it was, you know, a response to the approach that was taken to be reasonable at a time when change was possible in a particular way. The whole process of which is not conducive to a very simple answer. And I apologize for spinning a simple question into an incredibly convoluted response. But you have to take the view that you are a small part of a big system, whatever role you're playing. And that goes just as much for me and my organization who is speaking to ministers and to politicians as it goes for the person who is writing the letter to their local MP. Neither could exist without the other.
That's a really excellent point, that when it comes to building a critical mass in advocacy, it takes a concerted effort, that there isn't one person or one organization who gives them the Don Draper pitch and changes everyone's mind. That takes many, many voices to have an impact.
I mean, in very, very rare occasions, it may be that smaller coalitions can have really huge impacts. And, you know, I don't want to suggest that, you know, you need to have a million person march to get traction on a particular issue, because it kind of very much depends on the scale of the issue that you're needing to influence. So my example there, I'm talking about national politics, I'm talking about real large scale systems that are changing. But advocacy also works at a small scale. So I think maybe that previous answer doesn't communicate that quite as well. And then actually, if you are a local group with a local issue, you can be really, really effective at making change with a small coalition of people in your local area that you build around yourself. So at a national scale, yes, the suite of actors involved is so broad that you're rarely doing things on your own. But that, maybe that doesn't quite hold true at a local level.
You're right. At the local level, one person can have a huge impact. I think locally in Victoria, someone I went to high school with is really passionate about police reform. And for years now, he will be the only person attending open meetings of Victoria Police Department. And he live tweets the conversations and the discussions. And through him attending these things and tweeting, I then see it and now have a better understanding of something that I would not be aware of if not for his action of attending these things and helping to share that in a public venue. It's an interesting interplay. And I think that's what makes advocacy an interesting topic to discuss, because it is something that can be very wide reaching and involving many partners and stakeholders, or it is something that just one person with a passion can really make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, so that the person that you mentioned there and the action that they're undertaking in and of itself is not enough to create, an institutional change or a policy change, but it is a crucial part of that process. That creativity in raising awareness of an issue is bringing that awareness to a wider audience, and is hopefully stimulating people like yourselves to ask the questions and to be part of that kind of increasing momentum around an issue. Really good example of you don't have to set about to change a law or to overturn a development decision on your own. You can be a part of that process just by doing that awareness raising or whatever. It doesn't even need to be as big as live tweeting to a considerable audience. It can be speaking to your neighbors and speaking to your local societies and things.
What are some things that you think heritage organizations could be more effective in doing when it comes to advocacy?
As I said earlier, I think that the crucial thing for most heritage organizations is marshalling your support. And by that, I mean that aspect of inskilling and creating the behavior change in your audiences, your core stakeholders, to help you create a public legitimacy for the work that you do as an organization. And obviously that this is going to depend on what your organization is, how you operate, what you do. But if you are an organization that wants to highlight the importance of a museum in your town or a cultural heritage in your province, having that grassroots support is a real weight to getting you the legitimacy to go in to do those things. So your museum might want to talk to their local government about its funding allocation for the year. You need to be professional in your approach. You need to be well informed of your arguments. You need to have the data to back that up. And you also really want to be able to show that your subject is a subject that people are passionate about. And so I think that's a great place to start for heritage organizations, is to look at the people who support you, who you influence, and to get them into the mindset where their support for you can assist you in the policy objectives that you may have. If you start there, you know, the skills on how to meet with those local authority representatives, you know, they're easy to get. That's about being personable. It's about knowing how to collect the right kind of data. I think having that public support is probably just as more important as a first step.
Something I am a believer in is that when it comes to advocacy, it's more of a marathon than a sprint. That if you wait until there's a problem or an opportunity, whether it's an election or a funding cut or something that's in the news, and then react without having built relationships and developed public support, I find those advocacy efforts tend to be a little bit less effective than if you are constantly cultivating those relationships and growing support and collecting data. That if you wait, you know, say there's an election next month and you think, oh, I'll send letters now so we can influence people who are being elected, I find that generally falls a little bit flatter than if you cultivate those relationships over a longer period of time. Would you agree?
Absolutely agree on. And I think there are two separate points in there, which is the reactive versus proactive approach to advocacy. And you're dead right that if you, in a lot of situations, if you wait to the point that a negative decision has been put out or a piece of policy that doesn't take into account your area, it is by that point the best opportunity for influence has gone by. How can you stimulate that proactive awareness raising? That really does need to be part of your thinking. The second point that you make is about long term versus short term, and this is a crucial point for keeping an audience engaged with you, is that if you don't see change in a short period, people will lose hope and they'll drop away from a campaign or something. And it often takes many, many years of campaigning to really unlock the change that people are advocating for. And it is a marathon and not a sprint. And I don't think there's any easy way to hide the hard work and the heartache that can go into being a campaigner for something. But again, you only have to look at the Black Lives Matter to know how much a campaign like that takes time. It takes heartache. It takes effort. And if we see change for our children in a case like that, then we should count it as a huge success. Hopefully, you know, your average local heritage concern won't take quite that long, but it is often a case of years and not weeks or months. Now, the only kind of caveat that I would have to that kind of proactive versus reactive thing is that sometimes you can't help but be reactive in your advocacy. For all the best proactive preparation that you can do to raise awareness and stimulate support for your area, sometimes you will be faced with a situation that has to be dealt with reactively. And that has a positive effect as well as a negative one, because the problem with proactive advocacy is it's really hard to get people engaged and passionate about an issue when there is no immediate crisis. And the precipitation of an immediate crisis to get people involved in a campaign really has a lot of power, and it's a lot easier to convince people of the importance of an issue when there is an immediate threat to it. And that is not to be sniffed at. And the thing that I'd say about that kind of campaign is that often it takes a crisis to create a change. It takes the discovery of a highly important archaeological site to create space for a discussion about putting a protection for that archaeology into the planning process. It takes the murder of a black man in America to prompt the level of societal response necessary to create change around the world. That's a reactive campaign, reactive advocacy, and it's powerful. So it's not an either or, it's a both. You want to be improving the visibility of your issue and selling it as a positive thing in a proactive way. And then when something negative comes about that impacts that, not only do you then get to benefit from the passion of people who will be drawn to that issue given that crisis, but you will also have the benefit of having stored up this political goodwill. You've sold your message so well over the previous years that when the crisis comes up, you'll be much more likely to be listened to. So yeah, you definitely have to do both.
And one last thing, Rob, I know that you not only work in heritage advocacy, but you wrote a PhD exploring those topics as well. Are there book articles that you'd strongly recommend for people who are interested in expanding their advocacy knowledge?
Yeah, I can supply a reading list of some things which are very accessible and some things which are maybe only for the real committed campaigners of how do you get involved with making change. But let me supply that to you in writing, Ryan, and you can put it up on a website or something.
Yeah, actually that'd be great to accompany the post. That would be outstanding if you wouldn't mind sending that.
Cool.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today and in finding a time that works with the time change. Is there anything you'd like to plug? Can people find you on a social media platform, learn more about your organization?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if people are interested to see the work of UK organizations and advocacy, then they can find me at Dr. Rob Lennox on Twitter, and they can Google the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists if they are so inclined. But no, thank you very much for having me. It's great to get a kind of perspective about advocacy issues elsewhere in the world, and know that we share a lot of the same challenges in different places. And I'm very pleased to be invited to speak to you.